Moncrief on News Talk.
Our first guest lives not too far away from where we are now. One remarkable thing about the work he's published. Now, he's published work in various forms, but the seven novels he's published, all of them have been number one bestsellers in Ireland. So absolutely no pressure there. Donal Ryan, good afternoon to you.
Hey, Sean, how are you doing?
How's it going?
Great, right now.
Now, you're in Limerick now, is it?
I am. I live in Castletroy, yeah, but I was born and reared just down river here in Newtown. In Yahal Bay, pretty much. We swim every day in summer, every summer in Yahal Bay.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, this is kind of my home place, really.
Yeah, and you'd be familiar with Loch Derg then, and is that kind of, Loch Derg gone a bit fancy now?
Oh, it is very fancy now. Kind of always was, though. You know, we wouldn't have been passionate enough to ever be on the lake. Like, we'd always have been in the lake swimming and paddling, but we wouldn't have had a boat. I'm always amazed, actually, how people presume we must have had a boat because we live near the lake, you know, and they go, we didn't even say, did you have a boat? They go, what kind of boat did you have growing up? And we had a little blow-up dinghy from JKC's shop in Nina. I think it cost £4. We had it for about 10 years.
That was good value then for 10 years.
God, it was brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, but then local people would be using the lock as well, but whilst waving out at the
billionaires. Would, of course. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's fairness. It's a fantastic amenity for fishing and angling and sailing and all sorts of things, you know, and there's a great yacht club there in Drumminier, and it's a fabulous place, really.
Yeah, and so I suppose you're living in Limerick now because you're teaching creative writing.
I do. I teach creative writing at the University of Limerick, yeah.
Yeah. What's that like, given that you're a writer and then you bring a book out and you get reviews from people, but you're also kind of reviewing, in a way, students' work?
It's actually great. I love it, to be honest. It's the best job a writer could have, I suppose, because being a writer is built into the work job description, so it gives me time to write. And actually meeting the students is great because you have to really think kind of forensically and closely about how you write, because you have to try to explain how you do it yourself. Mm. You know? But also, I mean, you can't really say there's this particular way of teaching creative writing, because for every student it's different, because everybody's got a different ambition, a different style, a different way of seeing the world. So you have to kind of have to recalibrate for every student you meet.
Yeah. But
it's very interesting.
But does that require you, because, you know, when you first started writing, your first two or three books, were you thinking that much about what you were doing in this scene?
No.
Were you being that forensic about it?
No, I was flying by the seat of my pants completely for years and years and never thought about it. I just kind of thought, sure, I'm a genius, I'm grand.
Yeah.
I just do it, you know. I don't do my method. It just, you know, the work just, it comes through me from the university. I have no choice in the matter, you know. So, and then I got kind of a shock around my fourth book when I realised I didn't really know how to do it. You know, I'd been very lucky for the first three. And then the fourth one, I was thinking, Jesus, I better start actually trying to work out exactly how it is you do this, you know, because now I have to explain myself to people. Now, I never really thought it was genius, wasn't joking there, but I got lucky for the first two books, and I got a kind
for a while. But you had conviction. How many times were the first two books rejected?
Oh, dozens. I mean, probably up to 100 if you count in all the non-responses, because nobody wanted to know. But in fairness, like, nobody had money at the time. It was, you know, 07, 08, 09, 10.
Mm.
So, everybody was kind of broke and there was no one really biting very much. But I kind of knew, and my wife kept saying it, just keep trying, you know, just send out one or two manuscripts a week and eventually somebody will read it.
Yeah.
So eventually it was read in Lilliput Press in Dublin.
Yeah.
And that was it then, really.
Yeah. So then at the fourth book then, when you had to think about actually how you go about doing this, did that kind of make you look back on your other books and maybe I could have done that a bit better?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Actually, when I look back now, I think, I would do it so differently. But still, I'm glad that they are the way they are, you know, because they worked out. And I did. It was a lot of luck involved, really, now. But the thing is, though, I've been reading since I was 3 or 4 years old, nonstop. So that's the best apprenticeship you can serve as a writer, is to read and read and read.
Yeah, you know, of course.
That's how you work out how it's done. It's how you find your own voice. And you kind of have to emulate your heroes for a while as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to kind of write them out. Like Kurt Vonnegut said, it takes 5 years to write your heroes out. Julian Gough from Nina reckons it takes 15 years. I reckon Julian's probably closer to correct.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Gosh. So have you completed that process?
I don't give or do, because there'll always be echoes of who you love in your writing, you know, because that's what influences you. It's what forms you as a writer.
Mm.
The books that you love that really move you.
Yeah. The thing is, though, that is there a generational sense to every writer if they're influenced by a certain amount of writers and then their writing, but then other writers come along who in turn influence other writers. So things kind of morph along.
Absolutely. And it goes up and down because, I mean, I'm influenced by writers who only started in the last couple of years. You know, there are some poets around like Stephen Sexton and Martin Dyer and Emily Cullen who really influenced the way I write. And I didn't start reading them until a few years ago, you know. So it definitely, I mean, when you're kind of immersed in a creative field and people all around you are doing the same thing, you're always going to pick up their vibes and their ways of doing things.
And what way do have these poets influenced your work, do you think?
Just the way, like, I mean, poetry is incredible to me. It's pure magic. Actually, I have a collection here from a good friend of mine, one of our former students on the MA, Tiff Eccles, who lives just, actually, we're passing his house about now. But poets have to compress these huge emotional moments into a few words or a few lines, and every single moment in a poem counts for so much. Every single punctuation point, every single pause, the length of line, it's all so important. You know, a language has to be pristine, and it's almost sanctified in a poem language. You know, you can't be rough with it, you can't mess about with it. It has to be totally perfect because there's nowhere to hide in a poem. And that compression and that kind of that obligation to use language for its highest purpose, I think if you apply that to prose, it can have great effects.
Yeah, and in a lot of your books, you've used you use the language that people use growing up around you, which I suppose outside Ireland might kind of baffle readers to a certain extent.
Yeah,
are you still doing that? Because as I'm, you know, sure you're aware, the students you're teaching probably speak in a completely different way now.
They do. It's unbelievable, actually. And I feel really old sometimes lately, actually, when, you know, there's 19-year-olds in the class and I have to ask them what words mean. And then I start to try to use the words and sound like an idiot. And it's very funny, like, but like there's a particular demotic voice from North Tipperary that I use all the time. But it's probably particular to my generation and my parents' generation. Things have changed an awful lot. But then, you know, when I go back to Nina and the village I'm from, like I did, I was in Bobby Reedy's pub there in Newtown the other day, and everybody, it was so familiar, you know. And people my age and a bit older, maybe a bit younger even, were using the same kind of slang and the same kind of clipped words and the same slightly fractured sentences that we always use in Tipperary, you know. And it's just great to be there. It just feels so warm and welcoming because we have such a lovely way of using language. You know, we have just, it's, we kind of break things up and, you know, the way we speak in hyperbole and exaggeration and lies a lot of the time, you know, it's kind of a natural innate impulse in Irish people, and it feeds into how we use language.
Yeah, and do you think your writing will remain that way, given that, you know, spoken language kind of evolves over time, and in, you know, one of your books in 20 years' time might have people ending every sentence with a question mark?
I can't see myself stepping. Yeah, I know, yeah. It's true, actually. I mean, if I'm still writing in 20 years, please God. But I don't think it'll go away. I think there's a very strong rural inflection in Ireland, and it doesn't seem to change. Like, very young people will speak with kind of the same inflection that their parents have, because you learn to speak through your parents and your grandparents, and they're the people you love most, who are around you all the time, are the people who give you language. I mean, and language, like, so-called demotic language or vernacular speech is so beautiful, you know, and it ranges so much. But still, it's so universal. It translates fairly well. You know, people will always be able to figure out what a person means by the context of a statement, I think.
Yeah.
So things like, you know, just for finished, I was dog tired. Like, that'll translate fairly well anywhere, you know. It'll go far to finish. Well, in the end, obviously, you know, dog tired, fair to the dog. Like, yeah. You know, so, or, you know, I was wall falling with hunger.
Yeah.
I'm not sure quite what it means. Like, yeah.
The wall falling is just an Irish thing, really.
Yeah,
you know, I can't even think of an equivalent to that, really. You always would be have a book on the go in the sense of you're always writing one.
Yeah,
yeah. And do they always start from the same place? By which I mean, you know, you read writers say, "I just saw a vision of a woman sitting in a chair," or a plot point, a scene came up. Like, does it always start from the same place for you?
Or it does, yeah. I generally have about 15 false starts before I actually get going on a novel. So, and I know this is going to happen. So I'll have a really strong idea and I'll tell Marie and go, "Geez, that's a great idea." And she'll go, "Yeah, it's actually not a bad idea." And I'll start and it just won't work out. And that'll happen maybe on average 15 times before the proper idea comes, and then it starts to feel right. But I have a very, I tend to feel a little bit sick if it's not right. You know, if I'm on the fifth page or sixth page and I'm doing the wrong, writing the wrong book, my body will start to rebel a little bit. I start to feel a bit prickly and sweaty and slick.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit hungover. Sometimes I am hungover, so it can be confusing.
But actually, that was quite good. this is like 15 iterations of the same idea.
No, there could be 15 wildly different ideas that I think in the moment are genius ideas, and it turns out aren't great ideas at all, you know?
Yeah.
But I do keep all the false starts in a little file, and I'm very stuck for a little short story or something. I'll take one of them out and make it into something.
Yeah, okay, all right. And when you start with the idea, and if you're starting to make progress, do you know where you're going?
Oh, yeah, I do tend to always know where I'm going. I love to have an ending in sight, because then you've got a point towards which to work. And I find if you don't have that, for me anyway, there's this infinity of possibility. And that infinity can be oppressive. And so if I have this final point, this last scene towards which to work, it doesn't matter how I get there, but that's where I'm heading for, you know. Yeah. So it feels as though I've this, and I almost have a date in mind. I normally mark my diary and I'll finish the book around this date, and this is the scene on which I'll finish. And sometimes I write the scene very early, so it exists, you know, so the end point exists, you know, and it's such a relief. It feels like I'm finished almost, you know. If I have the first scene and last scene written, I go, actually, it's done now. All I have to do now is put in the middle bit, you know.
Yeah, how they get there. But can you, when you're going towards that end bit, can you be ambushed by your characters in the sense that you go, oh God, he'd never do that?
It's really annoying. Yeah. It's really, really annoying. And it does happen all the time. Like with the last book that came out, Heartbeat of Peace, the character of Kate decided she had a baby, and I didn't realise this at all. And then it was so obvious that she had a baby. And it felt like all Kate wanted to do was tell me all about the baby. And I was just writing it down, going, okay, Kate, thanks very much for this now. And then, it felt like she did literally step into the story and say, hold on a second now, I have to tell you about this. It felt like she was waiting for 10 years to tell me, you know?
Yeah.
And she felt kind of cross. But she's an amazing character. Like, my dad going to see the play of Spinning Heart years ago, and Kate, the actress who played Kate, delivered her monologue with an unlit cigarette in her hand. And as she was walking off stage, Dad leaned down and he went, Kate, do you want life for the whole fag love? Yeah. She was so good and he was so immersed, he totally forgot he was in a play.
There you go. You can't get better than that. Isn't the Spinning Heart on the Leaving Cert now?
It is. It was for 5 years. It was taken off, and it's gone back on again this year, just in time for my son Thomas to do it for his Leaving Cert.
Right.
You're raging.
And how does he feel about that?
Oh, he's not happy. He's not happy. The poor creator. He picked up his TY English workbook there before TY started and went, Dad, imagine if you were in this. And then the first page he opened, there was a photo of me. It was a paragraph from one of my books. The poor creator. I can imagine the embarrassment of it.
Yeah, but you know the way, like, worried about kids and being helped by AI or their parents. Now he can literally say, my dad says.
Yeah, it could be wrong, in fairness.
Donal, thanks a million for coming onto the boat with us today. Absolutely lovely to talk to you. Donal Ryan there, everybody.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.